Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the Indian Religions Podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Mohns Brew. He is Senior Lecturer of Comparative Religion at Åbo Academy University in Finland. And we're speaking on a really fascinating text that he sort of put on the map, at least for me, the Radha Tantra, a critical edition and annotated translation. This is a 2017 Routledge publication. Mohns, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a great pleasure being here.
Yes. And it so happens that we're colleagues in the sense that you're a research fellow at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, are you not?
Yes. That's a very exciting project, and I'm happy to be affiliated with them, and the great work they're doing.
Yes, I actually teach there. I'm a tutor there, and I serve on the course development board. So we may or may not have roped Mohns in for a course that we'll announce at some point in the future. But more to the point of this podcast, the Radha Tantra. So this must be a Vaishnava text. What is this Radha Tantra?
That was my first thought as well, of course. I heard the name. It must be an exciting Vaishnava text on Radha. I first came across the text in a bookseller in Kolkata. And looking at it, I quickly realized that this is something strange. Now, I guess for an ordinary person, the word strange doesn't have very positive connotations, but for a researcher, it usually does. So when I realized that this is something strange, I was immediately, my curiosity was piqued, and I wanted to see what kind of a book is this? What I realized fairly soon is that the Radha Tantra is a strange book in many ways. It's not a tantra as one would expect. Usually tantras deal primarily with ritual. Radha Tantra speaks almost not at all about ritual. Rather, the Radha Tantra is a story. June McDaniel, in an article on the Radha Tantra, she has called the Radha Tantra a Purana disguised as a tantra. And she has a point in that the main idea of the Radha Tantra is to retell the story of Radha and Krishna, but from a Shakta perspective. So what we're having is an attempt to kind of take over the narrative, to take over the story of Radha and Krishna from the Vaishnavas, and give it the Shakta slant. All of this makes the Radha Tantra an extremely fascinating text because, as I see it, it's a historical document describing the Shakta response to Bengali Vaishnavism in the 17th century. This was a time when Gaudiya or Bengali Vaishnavism was growing and very influential in Bengal. And a time when Shaktas felt they were kind of under pressure. So the Radha Tantra was one attempt at kind of countering the narrative of the Vaishnavas, basically by saying that yes, go on worshipping Radha Krishna, but you should realize who they actually are, and that they actually, both of them, are devotees of the great goddess.
I couldn't resist the impulse to compare in my mind this not so Vaishnava Tantra to the Devi Mahatmya. It was the primary text, it's the text I dissertated on anyhow. And where we see, you know, at the beginning of creation, at Pralaya, Vishnu is asleep and Madhu and Kaitabha threaten creation. But in this important to be working, it's the Devi's grace that empowers Vishnu. This reworking of materials through the lens of Shaktism, or really any whatever sectarian angle. It's brilliant, and the narratives so lend themselves to you know, competent storytellers and exegetes to rework them, and they're so rich. And as you were mentioning, June's description of this being a Purana disguised as a tantra. You know, it was only in the last maybe year or so that I've taken a closer look at the Devi Mahatmya, which I never thought was a tantric text at all. And I see there are extraordinary tantric themes encoded in the text covertly in narrative. So it really is a fascinating, exciting project. Before we dive a little more deeply into the content, tell us a little bit about, you know, this production of a quote-unquote critical edition. Tell us a bit about the journey, the manuscripts. Yeah. That might be a rich avenue of conversation.
For me, that was an extremely exciting and fruitful avenue of work. I'd never worked with manuscripts before this. So this was the first time. So it was very much also a process of learning, really learning by doing, going to different Indian libraries, sometimes struggling with bureaucracy. If you worked at any of the manuscript repositories in India, you know that it's not always the easiest thing to actually get access or to get copies. Even taking your laptop into a library in India might entail having to fill out 10 or 12 papers. So things are not always so easy, but when you kind of get an understanding of the of which ropes to pull and so on, it's actually quite fun. So what I did was I traveled around trying to locate all manuscripts of the Radha Tantra listed in different catalogs. There's an excellent resource called the New Catalogus Catalogorum that's published by the University of Madras. They started with this project of incorporating all manuscripts catalogs in one kind of super catalog. I think they started maybe in the 60s and it's still ongoing. They've reached maybe volume 50 or so. So fortunately, they've done the letter Ra already. So Radha Tantra is there. And I think they list about 45 manuscripts. Some of the catalogs they list or they reference some of those manuscripts are not available anymore. So I was able to locate about 35 manuscripts of the Radha Tantra, and I examined all of them. In some cases, got digital copies of the ones that were the most interesting. And then out of these 35, I collated 17. That means I went through them and compared them syllable after syllable with each other, trying to figure out, are there any differences in readings? Are there any variants? And then gradually figuring out how these different manuscripts relate to each other. This is a text that I think I'm convinced it's a Bengali text. Most manuscripts are found in Bengal, but there are manuscripts elsewhere as well. In Vrindavan, there are some manuscripts. There are manuscripts in Varanasi, up in Nepal, and so on. So I I did a bit of traveling, and then with the help of friends and colleagues, I was able to collect these manuscripts and then start comparing them. And this was very useful for me because I'm working on something similar now later on, but this Radhatantra project book came out a few years back, like you mentioned, really was like my training ground in this kind of philological and text critical work, learning all these things about how to do textual criticism was very useful. And I mean, you can learn all these things by reading books, but I find, being not a very bright person myself, that the best way of learning is by doing. And for me, this really worked in this case.
That probably means you're both bright and wise.
Well, I wish that was true, but I'm not so sure. But anyway, I learned many things doing this book, and there are some things I would do differently, of course, today if I would redo this project. I don't think it was actually necessary to go through 17 manuscripts in this way. I could have probably chosen fewer, but I wanted to kind of look at basically everything that's out there. This text, of course, is an obscure text. 35 manuscripts may sound like a lot, but of course, the Indian manuscript tradition is very different from the classical European one, where if you find 35 manuscripts of a text, that means it's hugely influential and popular. There are literally hundreds and thousands of maybe millions of Sanskrit manuscripts out there in different libraries in India. So 35 manuscripts of a text, it's not insignificant, but it's not a lot by any means.
Could you say a bit more about, in retrospect, and of course, we all have brilliant ideas about making a book better the minute it's published, right? But in retrospect, you would have used fewer manuscripts. Could you share for us why you say so, and say a bit more about, okay, how do you go about reconciling differences, or what's the process? You know, what's the philological process of condensing this into a critical edition? Mm.
Well, the reason why I said that I would use fewer manuscripts is that a critical edition basically has two things that it tries to achieve. One is to get as close as possible to the original text, the archetype or the author's text. We don't have that from the Radhatantra. We don't have the author's manuscript. Of course, the Radhatantra is written in the form of an eternal ancient Sanskrit text spoken by Shiva to Devi. But based on different things, I think that it's written actually in the 17th century, mid-17th century. I haven't seen a single 17th century manuscript. I've seen one, maybe two 18th century manuscripts. So I don't get that close to the original, but by comparing different manuscripts, I can see the ways they differ from each other and the ways they are the same. And if I find a manuscript, let's say in Vrindavan, in Devanagari script, another one in Nepal, another one in Assam, and if they all have similar features, if they are all the same, the things that are common between these three manuscripts probably say something about the original one. If there's something that is found only in the Nepali manuscript but not in the other ones, I can probably think that that's something that is unique for the Nepali one. So comparing manuscripts like this help me get as close as possible to the original text. But the second thing it does is that it also helps me see the differences. And that's an important thing of critical edition. A critical edition notes all the differences. And the reason I said I would perhaps should have used fewer manuscripts is that lots of the differences noted in the critical apparatus of my book are really not very important ones. there's somewhere there's a cha instead of tu, and so on. These are details showing differences between manuscripts, but they tend to kind of overshadow the more important differences. So the critical apparatus gets kind of messy because of all of these very minor differences. So getting back to your question, how do you determine the original reading? When one thing is finding out these kind of recensions or groups of manuscripts. I found, when I looked at all these manuscripts, I found that they could be grouped in different bigger groups. There are some groups that shorten the text because the text itself is written in a kind of rambling style. So at some point, somebody had thought that we can make this text a little bit better by cutting out some of the extra stuff. So there's kind of a shortened version of the Rara Tantra. The original text has 37 chapters. The shortened one has 32 chapters. And even within those chapters, some parts are taken out. So that's one variant, the shortened version. Another group is what I call the corrected version. And one of the things, one of the kind of main findings that I got from this work with the Rara Tantra was that we sometimes tend to think that ancient Sanskrit texts, they are corrupted by generations of scribes and copyists. That you have an amazing ancient text that is then gradually degenerated by careless copyists. And if there's a mistake in the text, that's because somebody has messed up in copying it. In the case of the Rara Tantra, I found the opposite. There were manuscripts that tried to improve on the text. Because the text doesn't represent faultless Paninian Sanskrit. It's written by a person who wasn't terribly fluent in Sanskrit. There's lots of vernacular influences, lots of grammatical mistakes, usually because of Bengali influence. The Sanskrit word for name, naman, like in Harinama, is often treated as it were, as if it was a noun ending in a, like Krishna. So you'll find forms like Harinamasya, the genitive of the holy name, or of Hari's name, which is totally wrong from the kind of standard Sanskrit rules perspective. So sometimes scribes, they correct these mistakes of the text. So there's one group of manuscripts where they tried to kind of fix the text. So instead of the text degenerating because of careless scribes, overzealous scribes have instead tried to improve on it. So these are some of the kind of differences between the manuscripts and some of the recensions of the text.
And this is really fascinating. Obviously, there are different schools of thought, and this is a very important question in the study of the Puranas in particular, as to whether the extent to which the use or the production of critical editions. We recently had on the podcast Peter Bishop and Yuko Yokochi, who are involved in the Skanda Purana project. And one of the things that they were talking about that's really echoing is the extent to which critical editions not only artificially freeze, I mean, there's a perspective that they might freeze a tradition, and they actually show the dynamism of the tradition in that they're preserving variants. Obviously, there are decisions to be made about what's to be prioritized, conscious and unconscious decisions, but nevertheless, the process of producing a critical edition in many ways demonstrates the diversity of tradition. And you can look at whatever end of the composition period for insight. So it's a really interesting, fascinating point. That sort of painstaking work is not something that I could do. So my hat goes off to you. It takes a great deal of patience. Talk to us a little bit about the content. So in your publication, you have produced your critical edition with notes, you know, the Sanskrit text, and then you actually translated it for readers in English. So tell us a bit about the structure you mentioned earlier, the number of chapters and the essential sort of content of, of Tantra.
Yeah, thank you. Well, the book, basically, my book has three parts, you could say. One is a fairly lengthy contextualizing introduction. Then there's the critical text itself, and then an annotated translation at the end. The basic story of the Radha Tantra begins with Vishnu in Varanasi. He's there in Shiva's holy city doing tapas, but he can't get siddhi. So he's unhappy about this. And then goddess Tripura appears before him. This is an interesting thing because the Radha Tantra, it's very much a Bengali kind of Kali Tantra style of text, but it has some influences of the Sri Vidya tradition that today you'll find mainly in South India. The Sri Vidya tradition is also a tantric tradition, one of the main tantric traditions alive still today, where goddess Tripura is the main focus of devotion and worship. So she features heavily in the beginning of the Radha Tantra. Also her Sri Vidya mantra is given in code form there in the beginning. Anyway, so she tells Vishnu that he should meditate on her Vidya, or her mantra. But really he needs to engage in Kulachara. Kulachara literally means clan behavior, and it refers, in the context of these kind of tantric texts, it refers to the sexual ritual, not the kind of sexual ritual of modern tantrism, where by adding some ritual to your sex, you're kind of upgrading your sex. But it's the other way around, that by adding sex to your ritual, you're upgrading your ritual. So she says that he needs to be born here on earth and then engage in Kulachara. And she's going to send one of her duties, one of her assistants, kind of a minor goddess, Padmini, to be born on earth as Radha. And Vishnu should be born as Krishna. And then they should engage in Kulachara together, and then he will get Siddhi. And then everything will be resolved. So then that's what happens in the story. Vishnu is born as Krishna and Padmini is born as Radha. And this is one of the central kind of parts of the text for its continuing life, because even though the Radha Tantra starts out in the way I described already as a kind of Shakta reply to Vaishnavism, the ones that actually read the Radha Tantra today, to the extent that it is read by anyone, are actually Vaishnavas, who see this as an ancient tantric text that maybe says some strange things, but also contains some amazing lila or amazing pastimes of Krishna. So Radha's birth is described in the Radha Tantra. Padmini is born then as Radha. She's born out of a lotus on the Yamuna River. And this story is retold by some Gaudiya Vaishnavas today, sometimes even referencing the Radha Tantra. So she's born. Krishna is there. They meet. But in many ways, the story is kind of a reversal of the story as told by the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. It's very much Radha who is in charge. And she's saying to Krishna, for example, that I'm not going to do any rituals with you. You're just an ordinary cowherd boy. So he has to kind of prove his divinity by showing his four-armed form as Vishnu. And then there's a whole from the point of view of literature, the kind of best or most fun part to read of the Radha Tantra is towards the end, when there's a whole story about Radha and Krishna meeting on a boat in the Yamuna, and then eventually engaging in the rituals. And then when they're done with the rituals, then Radha disappears. In the ordinary story of Radha and Krishna, of course, it's Krishna who leaves Vrindavan. He goes to Mathura and then on to Dwaraka. And Radha who remains crying after him. In the Radha Tantra, it's the opposite. Radha says, okay, I've done my work. Bye-bye. And then Krishna is left in Vrindavan crying his heart out after Radha. And then eventually he goes to Mathura and Dwaraka and he builds a big temple for the great goddess and so on. And then at the end of the text, there's also a hymn of the thousand names of Radha. There's a kavacha or kind of mystic armor with Radha's names. Another thing that the Radha Tantra does, which is kind of fun, is that it describes Vrindavana in great detail, making Vrindavan not just a Vaishnava holy place, but affiliating Vrindavan as well with Shaktism. There's this idea of these Shakta Pithas, 50 sacred places of Shakti all over India. This is connected with the story of Sati and Daksha's sacrifice, which of course is an important Puranic story that is retold in many different Puranas. And when Sati, Shiva's first wife, she kills herself after Shiva being abused by her father Daksha. She kills herself, and when Shiva finds out about that, he treasures Daksha's sacrifice, and he carries her body around, and he's completely overwhelmed by grief, dancing with her body in his lap. So the gods then decide that they need to get Shiva to calm down. So they think that the best way to do that is to make him drop the body. So Vishnu, with his chakra, he cuts Sati's body up in pieces, and the pieces, they fall down from heaven down on India. And the 50 places where these pieces fall down are then the Shakti Pithas, like centers of power. And one of those, the place where Sati's hair falls down, that's Vrindavan. So that's why Vrindavan is a holy place, not because of Krishna being born there or anything like that, but because of its affiliation with Sati. And this Vrindavan, this kind of mystical Vrindavan, is then described in great detail, but also given a kind of esoteric meaning that the external Vrindavan is there in India, but there's a kind of internal Vrindavan found on the petals of the inner lotuses of the body. So this is also described towards the end of the Radha Tantra.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is it's so fascinating. I have so many questions. One at a time, I suppose. Do you know if there's you mentioned this in passing. Could you tell us a bit about the life of the text currently? Who engages the text, if anyone? Is it ever engaged in ritual or ritually chanted? Part of the reason I ask is because of this kavacham and this sort of sahasranama of Radha, mm. and And so could you tell us a bit about the life of the text?
I don't know terribly much about it. I do know that they're sometimes mentioned. I came across a newspaper article about a family in Kolkata doing worship of Krishna on the Kali Puja day. They worship Krishna as Kali, according to the Radha Tantra. Now, the Radha Tantra doesn't give any directions like that, but there is a strong link between Krishna and Kali in the Radha Tantra. Krishna's body is said to be black because it's connected with Kali, who is obviously black as well. But there's an idea, of course, in the text that these Sahasranama, Kavachas, and so on would be ritually used. But I don't know if anybody actually does that. There are plenty of manuscripts with these kind of Kavachas and Sahasranamas and Puja Padhatis all over India. And there are many manuscripts also with Radha Kavachas. But the ones that I've looked at, and I've looked at such manuscripts in Rajasthan and in Bengal, they're not actually the same Kavachas as found in the Radha Tantra. So I don't think, I haven't seen any signs of it being really used ritually like that. It was printed, it's been printed many times. Maybe I'll say something about that later. So clearly there's been people reading it, and there are people reading it still today. But as I mentioned before, the only signs I've seen of people reading it and writing about it has usually been Vaishnavas, who then read it extremely selectively, just picking out a few places.
So why don't you comment on that now about the printing, that it's popular in print? What did you want to say about that?
Well, what happens with the Radha Tantra is something that's happened with many Indian texts in the 19th and 20th century as well. It's a while since I worked with the Radha Tantra now, but I think if I remember correctly, I looked at six printed editions of the text. The first one being from maybe 1878 or something like that, 1874, and then 1886, and so on. And what struck me quite quickly when I looked at these editions was that they all just plagiarize each other, every single one. The first edition, all the others, they use exactly the same text. They might add a different translation, they might add a different introduction, but they use exactly the same text. Nobody bothers to go back and look at any manuscripts. They just take over the same text and reprint it, add a few words of their own. This happens with many other texts as well. It's not unique for the Radha Tantra, but it's for a blue-eyed scholar who hasn't seen this before, that was quite surprising to me.
What else? One of the questions I was going to ask you, I might as well ask you now. There's so much to me that's fascinating about this text and this project, but you know, what struck you the most? What really sort of was out of left field, or what stayed with you? What did you find most striking about this text or this project?
One thing was the way in which scribes tried to improve on it. That I mentioned that already. The other thing that really taught me a lot and that I've had lots of use for afterwards in another project was the way in which the text engages in intertextuality. The Radha Tantra is written, as I said, in the form of an eternal tantra. It's Shiva speaking to Devi. Devi is sometimes asking questions and then Shiva is explaining things. But the author of the Radha Tantra, he made extensive use of earlier texts on this topic. I first noticed this in the way how the text, as I mentioned, it uses a kind of sloppy Sanskrit. And one of the kind of most striking things in the text, and you'll see that in the translation as well, is how much it uses these kind of standard vocatives, Maheshani, Parameshani, Devi, Priye, and so on. Sometimes you'll have like shlokas where you have Maheshani, like you'll have it in every single line, the author just filling it in with this, so that what a more competent author would have said in one shloka, the author of the Radha Tantra, he needs two shlokas to say that, because he's not so competent in writing. But sometimes the language changes. And when I first noticed that, I was surprised. Wow, really changing gears here and using a much more grammatically correct and much more varied and much more kind of technically astute Sanskrit, until I noticed that those places have all been taken straight out of earlier books. For example, there are two chapters in the Radha Tantra which describes Radha and Krishna and their friends and their clothes and their paraphernalia and their relatives and things like this. And I noticed that some of these verses sounded familiar. So I started digging into them and I noticed that these two chapters are taken straight out of Rupa Goswami's Radha Krishna Ganodesha Deepika, a 16th century Vaishnava text. So the author of the Radha Tantra, he clearly had access to this Vaishnava text, and he made use of it by what we today would call plagiarizing it, but which usually scholars call textual reuse. That he used some parts of it that he thought were useful for his project, made some minimal changes. When Radha is called the supreme goddess, like in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, he changed that to something that suits his own purpose better, but generally just took in that whole text. There's another text called the Varaha Samhita, which is an unpublished Vaishnava text on speaking about Vrindavana. It's unpublished, but it's available in many manuscripts in Bengal and Vrindavan. And this whole text is taken into the Radha Tantra. All of this description of Vrindavan with its different layers and coverings and different parts, straight up to the Varaha Samhita, just some minimal changes made to make it fit here. And similarly, the author of the Radha Tantra, he takes in stuff from other tantras, from the Tordala Tantra and other tantras as well. Takes in verses as they are, sometimes modifying them a little bit. And this, of course, is something that then helps me in narrowing down the date of the composition of the text by being able to check it with other texts. But it also says something about the social context of the book, that this is a time when these kind of texts were widely available, even by people who did not identify themselves as Vaishnavas, but they had access to these texts and they found them useful for their own literary work as well. So this was something that was very exciting for me and really kind of trained me in being a kind of textual detective, finding out from where some part is taken and from where something else.
You know, this really illumines for me. You know, I typically work on older Purana, so primarily the Markandeya, more and more the Mahabharata, but you know, the Devi Mahatmya, as you probably well know, it was housed in the Markandeya, the Surya Mahatmya. And you know, the process that you are describing and you're able to see in more detail, right, because of the other contemporaneous texts, it seems like you have a crisper, clearer vision of something I suspect to be true of the Markandeya Purana as well, where there is this patchwork ethos. It's a quilt. And my sense is not that the author, who knows, but my sense is not that the authors would be expecting their readers to be ignorant that these verses are elsewhere or that they were passing them off as their own, but this might be quite consciously done in order to link or connect. I mean, this the intertextuality of the Puranas can't be understated. It's actually mystifying and profound, the extent to which, I mean, the Markandeya Purana starts off by Jayamini asking Markandeya, "Hey, I read the Mahabharata and I don't know what this means, so can you help me out here?" And so one wonders if that wasn't a common practice where various sections would be lifted and incorporated. I mean, lifted really does sound like a more of a plagiaristic use, but incorporated consciously to sort of establish authority and to give credence to this new work and to kind of represent it as maybe commenting on or reworking existing works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah, that's quite possible as well.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. Earlier you mentioned that the Tripura Sundari Shrividya Mantra is coded at the outset of this text. Could you say a little bit more about that?
There's kind of language in tantric texts for describing mantras. Some mantras are held to be too sacred to kind of throw out to the public just like that. So you use kind of code words to indicate how the mantra actually looks, instead of saying, for example, "cling," you speak about the kama bija and so on. The Shrividya mantra, of course, is a very particular mantra. It has a very kind of, it doesn't look like anything else. So it's described in a way that if you don't know that you're kind of what you're looking for, you're not going to recognize it. And some of the early translations of the Radha Tantra, they don't catch this. They misunderstand these verses. They don't see what they're actually speaking about. There's many other examples like that in the with these early translations, and you can see that the translators, they were really mostly interested in the story. They didn't have the patience to sit down and figure out all the details. They wanted to kind of get the main gist of the text. And that's fine, of course. But I had the privilege and the fortune to be able to really kind of get really nerdy with this text and get into the details and find out things like when the author of the Radha Tantra made use of this Varaha Samhita text. He evidently had access to a faulty manuscript of it, because he's missing out some verses that you can see when you kind of really study the text. You realize that, wait a minute, he's describing here the north, and then he goes to the northeast, then he goes to the east, then he goes to the southeast, and then he's suddenly in the southwest. He's skipping the south part. So that verse is there in the Varaha Samhita, but it's not in the Radha Tantra, the one about the south. So he probably had access to a manuscript, maybe with some wormholes or something, where that verse was missing. None of the previous editors of the Radha Tantra and publishers had noticed that there's a verse missing here, because they just hadn't read the text really carefully. So I had the fortune, not because I'm a better Sanskritist than these people were, definitely not, but just because I had the privilege to put down the time and effort on this text. And that's, of course, one of the things we have to realize, that as modern scholars, we can criticize these early pioneering efforts of pandits in the 19th century or the 20th century. But they didn't have at all the same kind of facilities that we do. So it's not that we're better scholars, we just have more facilities and more time on our hands and bigger libraries to use. I mean, nowadays you can log on archive.org and you'll find books that just 10 years ago you had to travel all around the world to find these books.
It's a very important point. This is a really fascinating work. That you have presented in your publication. Is there anything else that you hoped we touch on before we close for today?
Another thing that I think the Radha Tantra taught me was that there's power in the Sanskrit language. People sometimes speak about the power of the Sanskrit language in the sense of vibration, and if you say the sounds of the Sanskrit language, that will purify your mind and so on. And that's, of course, totally possible as well. But I don't mean that. I mean that there's power in the Sanskrit language in the sense of the things that people imagine when they hear about Sanskrit and when they see Sanskrit. So everything points to the Radha Tantra being written in the 17th century, really as a kind of slap in the face of the Vaishnavas. The body of Krishna lovingly worshipped by Vaishnavas is in the Radha Tantra explicitly several times said to be made of matter. When Krishna dies, his body returns to the ground. Radha is not the supreme goddess of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. She's just a servant of Tripura. Krishna's Maha Mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra. That's all about Shiva and Shakti, according to the Radha Tantra. And it's also just a lower form of the mantra, meant just for Shudras. So it really is like a slap in the face of the Vaishnavas. Nevertheless, because the Radha Tantra is written in Sanskrit, and not very good Sanskrit at that, but because it is written in Sanskrit and it has the name Tantra, Radha Tantra, a discussion between Devi and Ishvara, Shiva, because of the power, the implicit power of the Sanskrit language, people today take it as a sacred, eternal book. And Vaishnavas read this book and see that, oh, this book mentions the Mahamantra. So this shows that the Mahamantra is an eternal mantra. And this book says some amazing stories about Radha and Krishna. So it's a valuable book, all through the power of Sanskrit. If this book had been written in Bengali, nobody would have cared about it. But because it's written in Sanskrit, it gets this kind of authority of a sacred text. So there's lots of power in language.
Fascinating. It seems that the language of the gods has power in both sacred and secular realms. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For those of you who've been listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Mons Brew on his fascinating work on the Radha Tantra, his critical edition with annotated translation, published by Routledge, 2017. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the power of the great goddess in her various forms. Take care.